This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Okay. Something a little bit exciting this week. We want to bring you a brand new First Time Podcast series to get you through this rather trying time. It's called Conversations with Friends, and we want you to pitch us. We want to hear the writerly conversation you have with one of your writer friends. We want it cozy, we want it frank, and we want you to talk about the writing stuff that is important to you. All you need to do to pitch us is to have a writer mate, your bios, and some talking points. Find all the details at thefirsttimepodcast.com. Hopefully you listen as soon as this episode drops, because you only have until 5 p.m. on Tuesday the 31st of March to get your pitch to us by emailing hosts at thefirsttimepodcast.com. We want to hear from you. Good luck. A quick note, our chat here was recorded a few weeks back, and as such, our discussion about our plans for the year now seems incredibly out of date, but we wanted to share it with you to remind you that there is a time after all of this, and despite how anxiety-inducing it all is now, we can make plans and routines, we can still have creative projects. We kind of wanted to keep it on the record, our plans, because even though there's been a massive curveball thrown at all of us, they are still there. So enjoy.
Okay, Kate. Hi.
Hello, Catherine.
It is a whole new year.
It is. I mean, are we still allowed to call it new year when we've already hit autumn?
March.
Okay. Yeah. We can.
Close.
We can.
It's close. New year means new routines. You, I know, have just finished the copy edit for The Mother Fault.
Oh, thank the Lord.
It must feel like the bulk of the work's behind you.
I think it does now. Yes, it does.
So what's happening writing-wise?
So writing-wise, I'm in the glorious, new, swampy deliciousness of a new project.
Why is that so cool? Like, I totally agree, but
it's the possibility. Yeah, you know how at the end of the project,
right.
The ambition, like that, you just, this is going to be incredible. And at the end of the project, you're both exhausted, you're excited and exhilarated about what's to come in terms of the book coming out in the world, but you've also got that slight disappointment that, you know, you're never going to reach.
It didn't reach the vision.
The vision that you had. Some very smart person has talked about this. There's great quotes about it, but I forget them all. So I think that the beginning, and you could go in any direction.
You can, and you're not troubleshooting anymore.
You're not troubleshooting. Although, what I must say, you know how we always say and people say it doesn't get easier every time, whatever, your seventh book is as hard as your first. What I will say is that this time the pragmatist in me is like, now hold up there for a second, Mildenhall. Are you going to do three timelines? You know, are you going to do this? Like, do you really want to write from that perspective? What are the problems going to be like that? So I am doing a little bit of what I hope to be pre-troubleshooting, which is don't make this project impossible for yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Did you do that for second book?
I think that's the lesson I've learned.
Yeah.
Is to simplify in some ways. I think you do definitely catch yourself, and I think you refine a process and become more comfortable with the fact that there's long periods in which you feel like you're riding into an abyss.
Yeah. Oh, the abyss.
So what does it look like right now? New words.
The journal document has started.
A whole new journal.
Very exciting. I did start it, like I've been working on it at the same time as the other. So it is the book three journal is what it's called. It's gone from absolute first concept, but you must not look at this document until you've finished everything else, and just the collecting of research. So I'm doing some research, but in that also.
So hang on.
Yeah.
Just for listeners, we'll just recap. For listeners that don't know, Kate keeps a really thorough journal.
Very thorough.
As she writes.
Yeah.
She's written about it in a fabulous article on Lee Kaufman's blog, and we will link in show notes. It is such a good article because I have heard so much about the journal. And I think you had first explained it that when you were talking about Skylarking, you couldn't remember when things happened. So in my head, I had it that It was just like so that you could tell the truth.
Yes, which when it kind of is.
It feels much, but it feels much more like the thematic stuff around why you're making decisions feels like the really
and
important part.
And it's become that. I mean, if you call something your catch-all, it becomes something, you know, it's massive. It's like 150,000 words. Like it's this massive document and it has become the spot. Yeah. Where everything goes. So I have found it really helpful.
So you have a new
journal? I have a new journal. I haven't actually, or maybe there's a couple of sentences in there that are like lines maybe for the book. Do you know what I mean? Like I haven't let myself start. I've got a character. I know a lot about the plot. I think I know the time.
Oh, you haven't done new words? Like it's just the journal.
It's just the journal so far. Yeah. So, and what I was going to say is that I've just this last week done some really fun kind of walking the ground research stuff in the area that I'm looking at. I'm going back to historical. And after that, I'm not going to say anything more about it because I'll put the moz on it. But you know, in that weird bit where you're like, how much research is too much research? Okay, back off now. Let's let the story take off and then I'll work out. I've heard Tony Jordan speak about it a lot, that idea of going back retrospectively doing the research after you've let the story take flight. Because otherwise you do a lot of, oh, I should be really focusing on this. And other people's stuff as well, because other people are so passionate about their take on the particular time or the particular theme that then you get a bit, oh my gosh, I must write a book that serves all purposes for all people. So that's where I'm at.
Right. So what will the plan be for writing?
So
you have a plan.
I have a plan. Have I got shiny, sparkly eyes? This year, because I've got a contract for this book and it is ostensibly due at the end of the year, my plan is to be a little bit like Jane Harper, J.P. Bamari. I'm going to try and write the thing quick instead of writing it slow. And when I say that, I mean I tend to angst a lot and I go back over and I do things.
Over words or over direction?
No, I'm not a words. Over, you know, like I'll write 20,000 words in the wrong direction, then I'll come back and I'll write.
Okay, so new words coming up. Where are you going to write them?
Well, this is the delightful thing, Catherine. I have my brand new studio.
Oh, my God.
Which my partner, Adam, has built me, even so far as to go as laying the carpet himself, which we have decided in retrospect was a ridiculous idea. But anyway, it's done. My main concern at the moment,
of course.
That does
feel weird to do.
Oh, he's like got it in his head now to finish the thing, to build the whole thing. My bookshelves. Oh, I've got a whole wall of white bookshelves ready for me to just put them in. And I am following, like, I'm following Damon Young on Instagram. There's a thread about how to organize your bookshelves. He's recommended doing it by color. Just
a lot of people do. I suppose the thing about color, A, it looks nice, but B, you do normally remember the color.
Exactly. That's why people go into bookshops and ask for the one with the blue cover. So I've done that in a couple of spots because even though I'm not meant to be in there technically yet because he's not quite finished, I can't help it. So I've got this 4 meter long bench. It's amazing to work on. I've started putting some books in there. But of course, it happens organically a little bit thematically too.
Yeah.
Like I've got.
I would have thought thematic would be the way to go.
Yeah.
But
and well, and also kind of practical in like
librarians
books to read for the podcast.
Probably
The librarians will get upset. One of my friends is a librarian. She's upset that I'm not going to go with Dewey. But, you know, you have your books for the book project that you're working on. And you've got things that you're using.
But Dewey is only really good for nonfiction, isn't it? Like otherwise it's just
alphabetical. Yeah, of course. But then also like the first time around I did my own bookshelves, I had my friends who were published. I had like one shelf. Now I've got a lot of friends in the book world, Catherine. It's more than one shelf. So that's exciting. That's exciting. Anyway, so my plan is to be in there between like school drop-off times. You know,
Monday to Friday.
4 days a week I'm aiming for. One other is kind of life admin and podcasting or what other projects are on. And yeah, kind of shut out, try and really limit email, social media, et cetera, to one short session at one point and then to sit in there and write and get down a draft, draft zero, messy, wouldn't show anyone, but the whole thing down, by the middle of the year. That's the plan.
Wow.
By the middle of the year.
So going to plan it out or just...
Nah.
Be strict on the directions that it
just,
takes?
Yeah, just keep on going. Be strict. Don't let it go too far in different directions, but just see what I come up with. I've actually done a bit of a map of time, not like my own time, in which, you know, where I need to be to get that draft zero before.
Could be a book a year.
Promo starts for the mother fault. I don't think I will be at all, but I feel like I can hold it lightly thinking about it as an experiment.
Yes.
You know, rather than thinking about this is what I have to do.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm up to, going home to my amazing.
I'm so jealous.
Amazing studio. Tell us, you have some exciting news.
Yes. I got into the Adaptable program.
Love it. So congratulations. Excited. Tell Thank us, what you. Does it involve?
So the Adaptable program is run by the Queensland Writers Centre in, I think, collaboration with Screen Queensland.
Yep.
And it's basically they're looking for books to adapt to either TV or film. So the cool was I sent the helpline in and I sent my new as yet unfinished manuscript in. I did it. I think they were due. It was a funny date. It was like the 31st of December or something like that. So it was sort of a really weird time. I sent them both in, and because it was that weird time, they'd extended the deadline. So when the deadline had been extended to, we were no longer away. We were back in Melbourne. So I fixed a bit on my on my uncompleted manuscript and emailed them and said, can I
resubmit,
and they let me.
Cheeky.
Anyway, so it came to the day that they were going to make the announcement. It's about 8 o'clock at night. I get the email saying, sorry, unsuccessful. You know, felt crushed.
Yeah.
Actually felt really crushed because I just had a really positive feeling about it. So I really felt crushed. And it made me think how much you can have an existential crisis over a rejection. Like, I just was like, what's the point?
Yeah. You've got more kind of invested in it than you actually thought you did.
Yeah, and I see why people don't send things out because that feeling of rejection. Anyway, happy story. Woke up in the morning and they had sent an email. Because I'd sent two manuscripts, the rejection was only for one.
They sent all the rejections out first, which of course.
They did.
Oh, my goodness. So you're in with the new manuscript.
In with the new one, which means I get to go to Brisbane with a few other, there's 25 of us all together, some authors that I know are going.
Bunch of they're going to go crazy on the Gold Coast.
Which will be a lot of fun. And so we have a pitching day. So it's a full day. And we pitch to
producers.
Showrunners. Yep. Don't even know what a showrunner is.
Wowzers.
Directors, other production kind of people. And it's one-on-one. So I imagine it's a bit like hard copy.
Yeah.
Hard copy was where you had a book and you had one-on-one meetings. And
so you know how to do this, Catherine.
Hopefully.
You've got this.
Hopefully. I'm excited. I'm really excited.
How are you going to prep?
I guess that's part of the program.
Yeah, okay, cool.
So we have a synopsis writing session coming up. Some people had to do the synopsis writing. We'd already submitted a synopsis. Yeah. Some people had to do this session because theirs wasn't any good. Mine was in a middle camp. You don't have to do it, but, you know, you might as well. And then we have a practice pitch, a half-hour pitch with publisher production is the word I'm looking for, production person, movie person. And then we get feedback on that pitch.
That's
comes
brilliant.
Up in a couple of weeks.
Even if it's great. Just the experience, that's all great.
So good. I mean, cooler, better in person, but that's not going to happen. And then the real thing. So that's coming up in about 6 weeks' time. I'm so excited.
Amazing. Amazing. I love that. Okay. So before you get to the Gold Coast and do your movie pitch, what does your writing routine look like at the moment?
So I have sent a draft of my manuscript to my editor at Text Mandy and I'm in waiting mode.
Still in waiting mode.
So I'm not writing.
How are you feeling?
I remember talking to Mark Brandy when I was debating what publisher to go with. He's with Hachette and he mentioned that he was working on his third book and I was like, third book? And he was like, I feel unmoored if I'm not writing. And that is exactly the word for it. Unmoored. I feel lost.
So what are you going to do?
Well, part of me thinks that lostness is probably, like, I should be more comfortable in the
In the lost, yep.
Yeah.
Because so I think your brain's obviously doing something in there during the lost period.
Yeah. And also it's sort of like it makes me think maybe writing is just this way in which like it's the opposite of mindful, isn't it? Because I always have it. I'm always doing it. And if I'm not doing it, I'm thinking about.
You have to actually be in your body, in your mind.
Be in the moment. Live in the world.
Okay, get yourself a new project. So what are you going to work on?
So I signed up for the Australian Writers' Centre's picture book
course. Oh, nice.
I've been hanging on a leave of absence at RMIT for literally years waiting to do the picture book course. I just have had to realise that I don't have enough time, so I'm doing it through the Australian Writers' Centre. It's great.
Amazing.
A lot of it is, it's predominantly audio based, and then you have online forums where you can chat to people and then you have assignments. It's so good.
And can you do it in your own time?
You do it all in your own time. That's I listen so to the audio when I'm driving to work and driving home from work. It's great.
And you already had, I remember, because I remember reading these in writing our writers group. You've got some picture book manuscripts already.
I do have a couple. I've got some terrible ones. I've got one that I want to polish.
Okay, and so what are you
it's
thinking
so
already? It's hard,
huh? It's hard. I've just realised you have all these epiphanies of things that seem self-evident as soon as they're pointed out to you.
And story, like we should all just be reading more picture books.
A great picture book is like the punch that packs is phenomenal.
Incredible. Okay, amazing. Now, should one even ask about major project 3 or should one not?
Long way off. Can't even contemplate. Well, have a concept, but can't contemplate it until this second one.
Until you get back through the edit and all those kinds of things. So when that starts happening again and for the edit this year, is it going to be Macca's?
Well, funny you should say that. I did a blueprint, a Radio National blueprint for living episode on writing at Macca's. And,
I love this.
I've not been at Macca's since because I haven't been writing. I have to link to it. I think it's been out.
Okay, let's
link to it. But haven't been back since and feel like such a fraud.
Oh, my gosh. Because if people are going to come
past
and check to
the
see
the person
if
in
you
the world
there.
That is always checking my lies.
Macca's so mustn't be bereft.
I know.
You.
They're all talking about me. I just know it.
Okay, because let's just imagine for a moment that you get the copy edit back and, you know, you're back on.
Yeah.
What's your ideal situation for the week? How are you fitting it around work, life, children?
So I'm also working more. So I've gone back to my 3 full days of the week at work, which suits the work because they merged the team that I was in was just planning. Now it's planning and construction. So I have construction projects, which you kind of have to be around for.
Also fun.
It is fun. Do you get to put I'm made out? For planning. Like planning has really long timelines. You can plan for 5 years.
This is why you're so
nothing
good
ever
at
happens.
Spreadsheets.
It's like, but the construction stuff is just not like that. It's like way more. So that's a bit of a balance. But I'll hopefully, ideally, go back to getting up at 5, going to my mum's house, writing for 4 hours, and then going to work.
Amazing.
It should be great. I think I'll be happier then.
We
lost.
Want you to,
lost.
So keep us, we're going to check back in on this. First time listeners, you can keep us honest to see how we're going and we can see whether it actually, we can do, it's like a live experiment. Does it help to have the hours from 9 till 3 to write all day and come up with something? Or are you best to be 5 o'clock in the morning, pushing it out
that
before
is
you
my
go
best.
To other work?
That is my best.
So this will be our experiment to
which
see
is why
what
I think
works.
Retreats are not the best use of my time.
Yeah, that's true.
Because
good
I'm only really good
over here.
I'm only good for a few hours a day.
Okay.
But it's nice to socialise.
We'll come back to you.
Eat some cheese.
It is my great pleasure to welcome Emily Clements to the First Time Podcast. Emily is a 27-year-old writer based in Melbourne. Her nonfiction has been shortlisted for the Feminazi Memoir Prize, the Ada Cambridge Prize, and highly commended in the Scribe Nonfiction Prize. Her fiction has been twice shortlisted for the Rachel Fenari Prize and earned the Melbourne Young Writers Award. She is a former editor for Voiceworks and Visible Ink, and The Lotus Eaters is her first book published by Hardy Grant Books. Welcome to The First Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's very exciting. We are not at RMIT anymore because we are, of course, in our brand new studios. But we, full disclosure, Emily and I have sat in class together in a fiction class. And I remember, and I have said this on the podcast before, I think, my jaw dropping to the table when you first read out like one of those kind of 3-minute exercises that we had to do. So it's a doubly enormous pleasure to have you here talking about your very first book. We're going to begin where we always begin, which is to ask about the first time you saw yourself in print. But I'll confess, I think I already know the answer to this because I heard you in another interview say you've never been in print until this, your very first book. Is that true?
Yes. Well, I mean, unless you include the, I did have a 100-word microfiction published.
We totally include that. So where was that?
Okay. So that was with Flashing the Square.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I remember talking about that at uni.
Yeah, that was a very exciting little competition where I got all the people who were longlisted. They had their piece like broadcast over Fed Square.
And did you go and see it there?
Yeah, I went and saw it. My family actually came down to have a look at my, they were like, oh, let's have a look at, you know, Emily's work go up. And I think they were kind of disappointed when it was just 100 words up on the screen for
it's
maybe
quite,
5 minutes.
It's quite intimidating as a first time though to see it across Fed Square.
Yeah, yeah.
What about at school, Emily? Did you write or publish anything while you were at school?
Well, as part of the uni anthology,
yeah,
we had like, but that was everyone had to be included. That felt like a, no matter what you wrote, so long as it was kind of had some sort of cohesion, it would be put in. So there was that. I shudder to think of anyone actually reading it.
We'll go back through the archives and find these things.
Oh, please do.
But so that means that the first time, did you see pages for the Lotus Eaters, or was it the first time that you got a hard copy of a proof copy? What did it feel like when that arrived at your house?
I think the first would have been the advanced reading copy that they sent me. And now, like, given how much it changed between, because the advanced reading copy actually went out before we had done a copy edit.
Which is how these things often go.
Yeah. And so for me, looking at the ARC now and knowing how many people read it in its pre-copy edited form, it just makes me like shudder a little bit.
I totally know that feeling. And writers sit around, I know, because I've been in these conversations talking about like what should be done about getting all those ARCs back so they never end up in the wrong hands or so you never have to see them again.
Because I have read like ARCs of other people that I've just picked up from little like free libraries and stuff like that. So I know that they are out there.
They're out there.
Yeah.
I like to, there's someone at my local op shop who puts them in. So someone must be in publishing and puts them in the Hurstbridge op shop. Whoever you are, I know what you are doing. And I buy them all because I'm so distressed at the thought of them getting out in the world that I just buy them all up.
You have an arc of arcs.
I have an arc of arcs, exactly. Okay. Because your publication day was so recently, I know that you can walk us through it. There are so many myths about what happens on publication day, like that you wake up to fireworks and hot croissants and, you know, flowers arriving from your publisher. We know this isn't true. Can you walk us through publication day for you?
So publication day for me was February 2nd.
Okay.
And my expectation of February 2nd was that I would wake up and the birds would sing and my book would be in bookshops. What happened actually was that like a week or so before that, I started getting photos from people saying, I saw your book. It's in, like, it's up, it's there. And I felt so unprepared expecting that. I don't know what I expected out of February 2nd, that if so long as it was on that day in the future, I would have control of it. I probably would have felt equally as anxious on February 2nd if people did spontaneously start sending me photos of the book. But seeing it so early, yeah, it just sort of, it meant that it had started, that it was out there. It was all kind of a surprise to me.
That's so interesting because I think you've hit the nail on the head there already where you say that you thought that you could control the way that it happened, like that you would be able to manage both your expectations and feelings on the day, as well as I think there's this thing in our head that we can somehow continue to manage what other people think of us and our book, and that is just never going to happen.
No.
Okay, so you wake up on February 2nd. You know the book's already out there. Did you have media? Did you have bookshop visits? What kinds of things did you have on?
On February 2nd, February 2nd was actually the day that I flew up to Sydney for a bridal shower.
Awesome. Because your life aligns in these ways where you are torn between the author life and the personal life.
Yeah, so I had to be 100% present for my friend, in her like joyous, like the lead up to her joyous day, and I had to just kind of put all of my book stuff aside But then the next day I was expecting, I knew that there was going to be an excerpt coming out in Sunday Life, and my friend just happened to have it on her dining room table, and I didn't realize how much I was looking forward to it until I saw that magazine, and I just fervently flipped through it like, oh my God, where is it? Where is it? And I didn't find it. And that like soul crushing feeling of, oh no, it's not in there.
Oh my goodness.
Just sort of like, and my stomach sank to my toes. But then I like emailed the publisher and they're like, oh no, it's actually coming out in 2 weeks' time. Like, oh, okay.
Okay.
I didn't care. That was fine. That was fine. Yeah.
But it's also, you recognized immediately how full on the roller coaster is, the up and down. I don't even care about Sunday Life, whatever.
Yeah,
and
whatever.
Then, yeah, that total angst. I want to, I'm going to skip straight to the Sunday Life excerpt because
right.
I have questions about that. When it did come out, what were your feelings?
It's funny you ask that because, again, because of how excited I had been to see it, like when I thought that it was going to be in there, I expected to be excited when it did actually come out, and I rushed up to the newsagent and asked, where do I find Sunday Life? And they're like, oh, it's in The Edge. Like, oh, I've never bought it before. But yeah, when I actually read it, I had this really strange kind of feeling of withdrawal where I just basically slunk back to my bed and curled up in the fetal position and like watched animal rescue videos on YouTube for the whole morning. It was an odd one.
Do you think it was a feeling of disappointment, more a feeling of exposure? You're 2 weeks in already. Had you been expecting something else? Can you put a name to it yet? Or it was just...
I think it brought up all of these feelings that the book is actually about, so which is kind of convenient, but these feelings of this very exciting thing is happening to me and I don't know if I deserve it. Like, here it is. Oh my God, it's in the paper that so many people are reading. They're going to find me out. They're going to like discover that I'm not worth all of this attention. And yeah, so I just kind of like slunk away to my bed.
Lots and lots of big feels. Because we're going to be talking about it so much, we should talk about what The Lotus Eaters is. It's memoir. Can you give us the brief pitch line? Because I know you'll have been giving it a million times already.
I haven't.
Okay, here's your chance.
It's a book about self and body and place that takes, it's set in my first year living in Vietnam as a 19-year-old. With a through line of my adolescence and how these two times in my life were like wed to each other.
In one of the interviews you did, you talked about expecting to feel orgasmic jubilation on publication.
Yes.
I imagine that there's a lot of other feels mixed up when it's memoir, and we haven't spoken to a lot of memoirists on the podcast yet, so I want to ask about that. Was there also trepidation about this work coming out into the world? It's deeply personal. It's very much your story. How did you prepare yourself for that?
I don't know if I have spent a lot of time thinking about the ramifications of memoir specifically. And I think that's maybe what has helped me a lot, is just not thinking about it and just thinking about it as though it is a fictional book that I'm just putting out there. I've started to think about it more now that my partner's mother is reading it, for example.
Okay.
So it's more, in the post-publication that I've started having that come up for me a little bit. But that's okay because it's already out. There's nothing. It's beyond. It's out there in the world.
It's out there, and it's not yours anymore. It's interesting you said about your partner's mother, because at your launch, your mum was there, and you talked about how your mum was reading it at your place in that kind of week of the launch and publication.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go? Can you explain a little bit about what that process was like?
It was interesting that she herself told me that she was anxious about reading it, like that she was actively putting it off because she wasn't sure what I would have written about.
But because you hadn't prepped.
Yeah. I'd had conversations with her where I kind of half said what it was going to be. I was like, oh, Mom, I'm writing this book. You should know that it has a lot of sex in it.
Yeah.
And she was like, yes, okay. Yes, I know that. You told me that already. And I'm like, oh, but it has a lot of sex in it. But yeah, I mean, it's such a typical me thing, though, that I always find myself most wholly and truly expressed in the written word. So actually, this was the best way for me to talk to her about some of the things that I've, I guess, wanted her to know for a while, but haven't felt able to, like, just sit down and have a conversation about. So in a way, like, the book is a bit of a conversation with my family. And with Mum reading it, even though it was a bit of a nerve-wracking experience to have her go to bed each evening in our apartment with the book and then wake up the next morning and just sit down at the breakfast table and have her be like, oh, well, why did you, like, oh, I just, why didn't you come home or something like that? I'm like, oh, yeah, it's an odd kind of feeling of trying to reconcile, like, the person that I am in the book and the person that I am now, and trying to make sure that especially my family, when reading it, are aware that this is, like, a long time ago for me.
Yeah.
And not to take it as something that's been, you know, fresh for me or anything like
that. That's really interesting, because I think I imagine for your mum it would have been a completely different experience. But even one of the reviews that I read, and certainly my own experience reading it too, I was like, oh my gosh, and this doesn't work very well on podcasts, but I'm putting out my arms to try and give Lee a hug, because, you know, you feel very protective towards the version of yourself who is in the book, the young version of yourself who seems so lost at times, and also is putting themselves in extraordinarily dangerous situations at times, or what we perceive them to be as the reader, and what they indeed were. So that's interesting that you've already grappled with this idea of that being a past you that you've kind of processed already.
Well, the act of writing the book was a kind of processing as well. I think that a lot of memoirists will find that in writing about something, you come to a deeper understanding of it. And while writing The Lotus Eaters, yeah, it was necessary to make that part of myself a character. And in making her a character, it meant that I was able to look at her objectively and to kind of cut a shape of her that was clearer and detached from all of, like, the baggage and the weight that I'd previously kind of tied her down with. And yeah, so in a deeper understanding came a deeper empathy. And yeah, there was definitely feelings of, I want to just reach through and hug her. Mm. And in kind of taking that step back, I was able to see that a lot of things that I thought were my fault were far more complicated than that. And yeah, it's interesting that, like, I never thought that I was going to write about that period in my life. But having written about it, I don't know how I could
have avoided.
Yeah,
that.
Totally.
You said in one of the interviews you describe a feeling of relief in writing down some of those experiences as a teen, and you can kind of see that on the page. In terms of your reading of other memoirs and your learning the craft of how to do this, what informed you in the approach that you've got in The Lotus Eaters?
It was a lot of hit and miss, really. I wish I had a more informed approach and I'd thought about it before I started writing it. Maybe it would have been a more streamlined process than it was. I started off in present tense, wrote the whole thing in present tense, workshopped the shit out of it, and then rewrote it word by word into past tense, like starting off with an entirely, like, blank document.
Yes, because you retyped.
I retyped.
You
yes.
retyped. Who, because I did this, I did this as well. I retyped because Charlotte told me to. Who told you to do it and why did you do it?
Nadine Davidoff.
Yep.
At the hard copy program in Canberra. She didn't explicitly tell me to do it, but she raised an eyebrow and looked at me in a particular way.
And I knew that was retired.
What I had to do, yeah. She was like, if you can't think of a good reason for it to stay in present tense, then it should be in past tense. And it was autumn at the time, and I went outside into the beautiful Canberran park, and I just kicked around huge piles of leaves for a while because the manuscript at this point, I think it was something like 120,000 words.
Wowzers.
So the idea of retyping that, like, word by word into a new blank document was just awful. But once I got started, awfulness of the process is actually what makes it so valuable, because it's so labor intensive. It means that you don't bring anything across that you don't absolutely need.
That's exactly it. And if anyone is sitting out there thinking, this sounds mad, why would I ever do that? I had exactly the same experience, that you just kind of slough off anything that is not required because it's so painful to retype it.
Yeah, I think as writers, we're very sentimental creatures. And
so sentimental.
So you quote unquote redraft, but you let things stay in there that you think no one will notice. So you're just like, oh, I just wanted to have a home. And why can't it just be here? It can just be here. No one will notice. And then in the retyping process, you're like, oh, yeah, that doesn't live there. That needs to go. Yeah.
I know that when we were at RMIT together, and this was why it was such a surprise when I read The Lotus Eaters, because it started as something not entirely different, but it had certainly different streams to it, if I recall correctly. There was time when you were writing speculative section in Vietnam. Can you tell us how it kind of came to be and how it morphed over that time?
Originally, my idea for it was that it was going to be a cli-fi memoir hybrid.
That's right.
And so part of the story would be based 1,000 years in the future when Hanoi was a flooded city, and would be about a girl like navigating that city with her pet rat Camembert.
That's right.
But I think that whole timeline came from an awareness within my writer brain that there was an extra level of depth that I needed to add to the story that's just like me in Hanoi. And me thinking that it was going to be cli-fi was just an elaborate way of putting off the inevitable, which was going to be writing about my adolescence. So instead of like going backward, I was like desperately scrabbling forward.
Could. Yeah. That's so interesting. That whole section of the book, which you're writing, and anyone who has read The Lotus Eaters already, and those of you who are about to go out and buy a copy, you'll know Emily is on the line, just the most sublime writer. What has happened to that flooded Hanoi with the girl and Camembert? Is it somewhere else? Can we see it at some stage?
She's living in a very long Parked Darlings document.
Okay, great.
That I have. I would love to return to just write, because fantasy is all that I read as a teenager.
Sure.
I absolutely loved fantasy. So I would love to go back and write some kind of spec fic, YA, fantasy, like beastie.
Amazing. You heard it here first on the First Time Podcast. Just wait and see what's coming. In terms of your time at RMIT in PWE, you know, we are always engaged in that old chestnut about, can you learn the craft of writing or can you not? Mm. What we think that you can, because Catherine is still at RMIT as well. Yeah, we are yet to graduate. You have graduated, though, Lee. What are the greatest lessons or benefits that you took away from the course?
I think workshopping was a skill that I did not have before the course, and that really carried through into my position as editor at VoiceWorks as well. And I think in that, like, learning how to step back and kind of look at the strengths and weaknesses of someone else's work, it means that you can do the same for your own work in a much more constructive way. Whereas I think before the course, I was either like, this is amazing, this is the best shit ever, or this is horrible, this is trash, I have to delete the whole thing. Whereas now I've kind of more reached a middle point of there's good and bad and everything, and that a lot of it just needs to be reshaped. And PWE definitely gave me the tools that I needed to reshape things. And as well as that, you know, it gave me the grammatical scaffold that I needed.
Didn't it just? I so often try and go back to all of those notes.
I mean, even if it did kind of mess with my mind a little bit in terms of, you know, M dash versus N dash and colon, semicolon, all that kind of thing.
But so nice to be able to just procrastinate over those kinds of thoughts when you're in the middle of writing or editing.
Yeah, in the proofreading, I think that was a big last minute, like, scrabble for control of, you know, just like emailing my editor with probably the most infuriating little emails, like, oh no, no, I found another one. I found another one on, you know, on page like 68. That can't be a comma. It absolutely cannot be a comma. It has to be a semicolon. I'm so sorry, but this is very important to me.
Oh my gosh, you are that writer. Tell me about the editing process. How did you find it coming from this position as both writer and editor?
When I first had a chat with my editor or my publisher, Arwen Summers, I was a little bit concerned because she said that it would just be a light structural edit. And I heard that and I panicked a little bit because I thought, no, it needs a thorough bashing. It needs to be taken out and just, you know, whipped behind the stables. But then actually when it got down to it, the structural edit was really thorough, and I like just quiver in fear to think of Arwen Summers' definition of a heavy structural edit.
I think that all the time when those notes come back, and I think maybe that's just what editors do. No, it doesn't need much at all. And then you get it back and it's covered with queries. You think, oh my Lord.
Yeah. So that was really hard, the structural edit for me. I think particularly because it was memoir. And so a few of the comments that came back were very much like, you know, this is, I don't understand what's happening here. I want to throw the book across the room. Help me like stay in this event. And as a person writing about their own experience, you're like, oh God, my experience is frustrating someone to the extent.
Wow, that's really hard.
Yeah. So that was a bit of a grueling process to bring myself back to the document day after day. And
what kind of time frame did you do that over?
I think it was about 2 months. So it was very concentrated. I got the structural edit back in the way that these things always happen. I got the structural edit back the week before I was due to go overseas.
Of course you did.
So that was 6 weeks cut out of the schedule that I otherwise would have had at my disposal. So
wow.
I think we had 2 months for the structural edit. And then I think it was only a matter of maybe a couple weeks for the copy edit. So that felt quite right. But they were assuring me the whole time, like, oh, we're very confident that it's very clean. We'll get this done. And meanwhile, I'm like, no, but what if I miss something? What, you know? And I was always like looking for another opportunity to kind of comb through and find like little nitpicky things that no one
else
would notice.
Which is very brave of you, because I know certainly at the point that I'm at right now, which is post copy edit, post proofread, I never want to see another word I have written again in my entire life. So I think it's an extraordinary level of energy that you've brought to it to be able to go back and look through it again and again. I'm going to listen back to this next time I have to do it to think, do it how Emily would have done it.
Well, I haven't actually read, now that the book is in print, I haven't. Like, is this a thing that writers do? That do they actually read the final version of their books?
Oh God, no, I don't. I mean, like, except I think what's difficult is that when you're asked to do readings, which I don't know if you've done in events yet, I just constantly edit as I'm doing that, as I'm reading it aloud. I'm thinking, oh, same thing. Why is that comma there? It should not be there. So it's hard to look back. But I have heard writers say that the 15-year period is quite nice to go back and look at it.
Lovely.
So there you go. You can look forward to that. I want to ask you about the book now being out there and outside of your control. How are you dealing with reader responses, with reviews? How is that kind of working for you?
It's been great, mostly. I do often like trawl Instagram looking for my own hashtag.
Yeah, that's okay. That's perfectly acceptable.
And for the most part, yeah, it's been like people have been really great. Like, I loved hearing back from a total stranger message me to say that she read an excerpt on a Virgin flight. And that she loved it so much that she rushed off the plane and bought a copy.
Amazing.
Straight away. And that blew my mind, because I didn't even know that there was an excerpt on the Virgin, like,
amazing
in-flight entertainment kind of thing. And that was very exciting. I think even though I absolutely love getting feedback from people that I know, there's a part of my brain that says, oh, they have to say that.
Sure.
And even from my editors and from Hardy Grant, who've been very supportive from the beginning, said all these lovely things. And I just thought, well, they have to say that, they're my publisher. So I think the things that kind of just make me sparkle the most are the unexpected ones.
And are you responding to people? Have you got to put a policy in place that you're like, I'll immediately respond, I won't, I'll retweet good reviews? What's your kind of policy in your head?
I think I've just kind of filed most of them. Like, I put most of them in my stories on Instagram because I figure that I don't want to like bloat my page with that kind of thing. I'm not very good with Twitter. I don't think I've posted very much there since the book has come out.
That's interesting because one of my questions to you, or one of the things I want to talk about, is your absolute brilliance on Twitter when you live tweet events.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I wanted to ask you because you have another life as a captioner.
Yes.
Is that the right word?
Captioner? Yeah, we call ourselves captioners.
So I wanted to ask, A, is the skill there because of captioning? And B, what does that mean for who you set yourself up for on Twitter as well?
Well, I think maybe the reason why the like live tweeting like works so well is because I'm really only doing it for myself. And I think that's the same with most things, that when you do it for yourself, first and foremost, it's going to be the most valuable.
Because like, you're not worried about that.
Yeah.
That other glance.
And you're not putting on pretenses or anything like that. Like when I'm doing that, it's literally the fastest way for me to take notes. And also because of, I guess, captioning, like I'm used to getting input and outputting at the same time. And so I can kind of almost simultaneously listen and write.
So impressive. I should say this now just as a public service announcement, that if Lee's at an event and she is live tweeting it, you really don't have to listen. You just know that you're going to have this full record. If you go back through the Twitter archive, you'll find her live tweeting of Broadside, which was absolutely amazing. Did your publisher prep you at all for how to be on social media or how to approach it during the publication kind of period?
We had in one of the initial meetings, they did say that we do expect you to market yourself. And I heard that and I was like, oh, I'm not going to get any publicity whatsoever. I have to be doing all this on my own. And that's kind of what I expected, I guess, from what they taught us at PWE about, you know, like marketing budgets and that kind of thing.
Expect a little.
Oh, there's going to be nothing, but that's fine. I can do it. And then actually they came back at me and they said, no, we don't mean nothing. We just mean that we'd like you to be out there in some sense of the word. And that's been not like I kind of thought, oh, I'm not going to be a successful writer unless I have thousands of followers on Twitter and Instagram and all the other stuff. But actually the way that my publicist talked to me about it was like, oh, just make sure that you keep your family and friends updated.
Okay, and that's, great.
Yeah, essentially the approach that I take, because otherwise, you know, I have my mom messaging me saying, oh, what have people been saying? Where are your interviews? Where can I find your interviews?
Excellent. Okay, that's a nice way of thinking about
it.
How are you fitting it into your day? Because I know that in that initial period where you are getting things coming at you and you're also doing events or visiting bookstores, you can feel like your whole brain and life is occupied by Instagram, for instance. Are you setting yourself up with certain times? Are you having phone free times? What are you doing?
I should. I absolutely should be.
There are no shoulds here.
Well, I wish I was, because I think it can be very easy to just get into the pattern of I'm checking everything, I'm updating, where I'm messaging people where I need to message them. For someone who is at their core a people pleaser, it's also very hard not to immediately just thank everyone who says nice things to me. But I think that going forward, I would really like to put a time cap on how much time I'm spending on these kinds of things, and not feeling so bad, like not feeling like I owe someone something because they've given me a nice review or something like that. Because at the end of the day, I can check my app info and it will tell me that I've spent 2 hours on an app. When I have like a whole stack of books that I would love to be getting through. And that in the end is what is going to make me a better writer over social media, like every time.
Excellent advice right there from Emily Clements. In terms of events, I know that you had your launch, you've been doing book visits and things. What kind of events have you got coming up? What have you enjoyed the most?
So I've got a event with Sophie Hardcastle.
Oh, fantastic. Whose book is just out?
Yes. Below Deck came out. If it wasn't yesterday, it was the day before yesterday.
Excellent.
So that's very exciting. I saw Sophie at the Emerging Writers Festival a couple years ago when her debut memoir came out. And I remember listening and just feeling, you know, that like hot, squirmy, jealous, like
I know the feeling. Yep, that one.
Feeling like, ah, oh, you're like my age and you've already put out a memoir. And like the core of that is like, I want that to be me. And now that is me. So it feels very appropriate that like my first event ever is going to be with Sophie. And then after that, we've got an event at the Bookbird in Fantastic. Geelong, which is, I think, the only independent bookstore in Geelong.
Amazing. Shout out to you.
Yeah. So I'm going to be doing an event there with Elena Savage, which will be wonderful.
All the great books coming out at this time.
Yeah.
How are you? Are you doing anything to prepare for those? Are you nervous about them? Are you excited?
Apart from just reading the books, like I've got Below Deck and I'm going to be hunting down blueberries as soon as I can. Apart from reading them, I've found that actually coming with a more like off the cuff approach works better for me because otherwise I overthink it.
Right.
And I try and memorize, you know, certain things and it doesn't come across as fluid and organic in the way that like I personally like to hear writers talk about their work.
Very good. More excellent advice. Your writing routine, I know that you work as well, that mm-hmm. this is your first time published. I don't know if you have another contract with Hardy Grant. How has it changed and what does it look like now since publication?
So 2019 was quite an industrious year in that deadlines forced me to be spending a certain amount of time on the manuscript.
Yep.
And sometimes it wasn't exactly regular. It would be more like I, for example, went to Europe for 6 weeks and then I came back with a massive project ahead of me and I would spend 6 hours a day on it, like around work and all that kind of thing. Before that, before the contract, I was putting aside 2 hours a day for writing.
In the morning, at night, before eating, but like I'm so interested in where you actually fit these hours in.
Usually evening.
Yep.
Because I'm just not a morning person at all. And unfortunately my work is also in the evening. So I would usually finish work around 7, come home, have dinner, and then begin. Yeah. And then be faced with kind of just a nighttime write. But that's my favorite time to do it.
Okay, great.
It does kind of kill your social life a little bit, but like I feel so much happier when I do have a writing routine and I know when the next time I'm going to sit down and write is going
to
be.
Have you been able to write in this kind of roller coaster period of publication, launch, events?
What's really helped actually is I'm working on a chapbook with Slow Canoe.
Amazing.
And they're a really great little publication that I've only just heard about when
Fantastic.
They approached me for it. Yeah. And their work is just based around like 300 word pieces. And so that's just been a really nice little
palette cleanser.
Yeah. Just to be able to not like nothing too stressful, nothing too structured. It's just like, oh, I have 300 words to write for the weekend. And then just sitting down and doing that. And that's been a really nice like pick me up. Instead of the big weighty, you know, thought pieces and essays that I feel like I should be writing. And because I feel like I should be, I haven't felt inclined to.
Of course.
Yes.
You have given us great advice already. The advice that comes from a writer who is in the middle of their debut experience is different from someone who has is thinking about it a long way in the past. So I want to ask you right now, if someone was coming up behind you about to launch their debut book into the world, what advice would you give them?
Ooh, I would say, I don't know, is just enjoy it a bit broad. Like, I think, well, if I was going to look back at the way that it's happened for me, I guess... Actually, I wouldn't do it any other way.
That's great. do it as Emily's done it.
Yeah. I mean, I... Oh, this is a good piece of advice that someone else gave me that I'm very glad that I took, was I just took time off work.
Yeah.
So I deliberately took February off, and it just meant that I could just sit in, like, just sit and ride the roller coaster wherever it took me. I didn't have to, like, make awkward faces at my work colleagues, like, knowing that they knew that I'd written a book.
Yes, great.
I'm really glad that I took that month off. I didn't have something to do every day, but it meant that in the days that I didn't have anything to do, I was just free to, like, think and read, and it was, yeah, very worthwhile.
Fantastic advice. Before I let you go, what is your favorite novel by a debut author, any time, any genre? Most difficult question.
Well, so the first book that I read this year, actually, called Word Slut by Amanda Montell.
Excellent.
That's her debut book. Yes, it is her debut book. And it's a nonfiction exploration of feminist linguistics.
Amazing.
And it taught me a lot about the way that language forms, like, well, language maintains patriarchy, and how we maintain language and what that means, and goes through all these, like, really interesting examples. Like, I'm sure we're all word nerds, so
it
goes through all this kind of, like, you know, etymological, like, trivia about, like, the history of words and the ways in which, like, female words or female nouns tend to be, like, degraded over time, while male nouns tend to be promoted, in a sense. Anyway, it's
so interesting.
It's very interesting and very approachable, and I just absolutely, like, devoured it.
Okay, we'll put it straight into our show notes. Emily Clements, it's been an absolute joy having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was heaps of fun.
Okay, Emily, for your first time quick five, and remember, you're allowed to pass on any question, and they may not be relevant because you are so fresh in this.
Okay.
For your first time, were you agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
Overseas territories.
Oh, which ones?
I think.
Oh,
wait.
Are we not allowed to announce this yet?
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, I'll have to have a look at my contract.
Okay, that's all right. That's all right. Hold. Festival invites or no festival invites?
No festival invites.
So far.
So far.
Get straight onto Emily Clements now. And you wouldn't know how many copies have sold, but we hope it's heaps and heaps and heaps, and everyone should go out and buy multiple copies right now. You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.